Hello, this is John Mullen at the Guardian Book Club, and I'm talking to Philip Pullman about his trilogy, His Dark Materials. And it's a special pleasure to do this because I know Philip has said that he doesn't specifically think about children, writing for children, when he writes, but his books have clearly been loved by hundreds of thousands, probably millions of children. And I think adults, perhaps particularly adult book lovers, have a tendency to think of the books they loved as children and sometimes assume that it was somehow that the love for those books was part of simply the sort of emotional texture of being a child, rather than, as I think it's often the case, also because of the artfulness of the books, which have especially lingered in the memory. And I think I'm especially keen to be able to kind of devote to children's books, so-called, some of the kind of attention that normally gets saved for supposedly adult literary fiction. So you'll forgive me, I hope, if I start by asking Philip some quite sort of literary questions about it. And I want to start with the plot, actually, because that's kind of quite an important thing, I think, to most readers. And I mean, if this isn't giving away secrets of the craft, I wondered, you know, you get these things in some of the surviving notes that Dickens left, the chapter plans of his novels, and you can see the things, you can actually see the things that he absolutely decided in advance, from the word go, and the things he sort of discovered or invented as he went along that weren't necessarily part of the sort of original game plan. I mean, is there a difference between, there must be a difference between those two things for you. I just wondered which were the absolutely essential things about how it was going to go, which are there from the beginning, and which things were sort of discoveries for you?
Yes. Well, Dickens, of course, wrote for serial publication. So he would write a book which was being published as he wrote it. And so some of the things that were in previous episodes were fixed and he couldn't go back and change them. That keeps you on the edge of your seat, that sort of writing, because you've got to think backwards and forwards at once. Fortunately, I haven't had to do that. I've been able to make my mistakes and then go back and correct them before the book is actually published. Not that Dickens made any mistakes, or very many anyway. He was such a wonderful inventor and spinner of stories and plots and wordplay and so on, that his inventiveness never seemed to pall, or rarely anyway. What did I have fixed in advance? Well, I had not very much. I had the starting point, which was the little girl going into a room where she wasn't supposed to be and overhearing something that would intrigue her and set the story going, really. I thought that was quite a good starting point. But I didn't know what it was going to be that she was going to overhear. That was a minor thing, which I'd find out when I got there. I'd discover it with as much eagerness as she would. Other things, what else did I have in mind? Well, one thing I did have in mind was a sort of destination. I knew that the book was going to end I didn't know where, and I didn't know when, and I didn't know how, but I knew in what mood, in what emotional tone it was going to end. And I knew that as a sort of fragrance, I suppose, or a particular chord of music that's very hard to describe because it's played in a particular orchestration. I'm not saying this very well, but it's a blend of things that I knew I could sense as strongly as I could sense, the taste of whiskey if I was drinking a glass of whiskey. It was that strong. But I didn't know anything more particular about it than that, except I knew that was where the book was going. And the question was how to get there. Well, some of the things that Lyra heard in that when she was hiding in the wardrobe in the retiring room, the senior common room, in effect, of this imaginary Oxford College, were things I was also curious about. I wanted to go north. I wanted to go to the Arctic. I'd never been to the Arctic. I never have been to the Arctic. But I love the Arctic as a place to think about, to dream about. So that was one thing. And another thing, another thing I discovered as I was listening with her to what was going on in the retiring room, were a couple of words, a couple of phrases that I thought, well, that's intriguing. I wonder what that means. I'll come back to it later. One was dust. So I wanted Lord Asriel, I wanted the uncle figure, she still thinks of him as an uncle at that point, to say something to the scholars which would make them go, oh, not that. Oh, my God. Anything would have done. You know, he could have said coconut or something. It wouldn't have mattered. I wanted that reaction from them. So he said dust, and that got that reaction. I didn't know what dust was, but I knew I'd find out later on. I knew Lyra would, too. So when she hears it and hears their reaction to it, she knows, oh, it must be a special sort of dust. I wonder what it means. I wonder what it is. And that leads or led to the sort of moral reversal, if you like, at the end of the first novel, the end of the first book, when she, who's been told all the way through that dust is this dreadful thing and dust is evil and dust is something to be shunned, and she realizes it's almost the first step in her moral education. She realizes, well, all these people have done terrible things and they think dust is bad. Well, maybe dust is good. And that's a big step towards her growing up. So that was how dust came about. And the other phrase that I heard with her for the first time was armored bear. I thought, well, she got to the north. What have they got in the north? Well, polar bears. Well, let's make him even fiercer than that. Give him armor. Armor bear. All right, yeah, we'll deal with that when we get there. So I gave it a mental sort of tick, and I thought, well, we'll sort that out when we get there. And when we get to this little town, Trollesund, in the Arctic, and Lyra meets Yorick Bernison for the first time, and I met him as well for the first time, and I heard what he said to her, and I sort of, I could hear his voice, and the one thing I regret about the audiobook is that I wasn't allowed to do the bear. So Sean Barrett does it. He does it very well, but I still like it. Anyway, at that point, I realized something about this bear. I realized he was much more important than I thought he was. And this is a little plot thing. My first instinct was to say, he's a special bear. He's the king of the bears, and he's lost his throne, and Lyra's going to help him get it back. My second instinct was to say, no, that's too, it's a cliche. It's too ordinary. It's an obvious thing to do. No, avoid the obvious. Don't do that. And my third thing was to say, and I stuck with this, don't be afraid of the obvious. Obvious things like that play a very big part in stories, and they're very important. It was important that he should be the king of the bears. It was important that Lyra should help him regain his throne. So I didn't avoid the obvious, and I went for it, and I think it worked.
It's funny you should talk about the ending, or your sense of the kind of the atmosphere, the smell of the ending, as something that you had an idea about from very early on. Because I was thinking about, as I read, what I expected, what sense of a kind of overall shape I had as I read. And I suppose I would describe, I think the ending's terrific, the whole last chapter. And I suppose I would call the ending a sort of very sad, happy ending. Kind of thing,
yeah.
And I don't know. I couldn't put my finger on where, but I sort of think may not correspond to the moment, as it were, when you saw exactly how it was going to work out. But I think from relatively early on, certainly in the second, in the Subtle Knife, I sort of thought two things alongside each other. One, I suppose I thought, well, there is in a sense going to be a happy ending. Because there's so much about destiny and prophecy, and Lyra's going to, she's got to fulfill that. And I thought, they come from separate worlds. So I think I knew, I had a premonition from quite early on that design meant that they were going to have to sort of be separated at the end.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I felt this too on the way through, and I tried to resist it. I didn't want that to happen. I was very sad for them, but it had to happen. And actually, the book is more successful because of it. People are very sad about the sad ending. They don't like the sad ending. They wish it was a happy ending. But it wouldn't have been nearly as much of a success, actually, if I'd given it a happy ending. It would have just fallen flat. If you want to know what that ending sounds like. See if you can find a recording of a little piece of music by Elgar called Sospiri, Sighs, Sospiri. It's a little 5 or 6 minute piece. I heard it quite by chance on the radio as I was driving along, and I had to stop because it is exactly the mood I was trying to evoke in that last chapter. And if they make that the film, if they get to part three of the story and making the film, I hope they will use something like that in the soundtrack. But that's what it sounds like.
Yeah, and that you even have them. I was rereading it, and I had forgotten. I hadn't noticed it the first time that you even have, because they agree to do this, as it were, virtual meeting on the bench. Presumably, it's a particular bench, is it, that you?
Yes, it is. Yeah,
in the Botanic Gardens. And actually, I hadn't, I think, noticed the first time that you even. I think it sort of adds a twist in a good way to the sad bit of the ending, and the sense of it, its inevitability as well, that you have, I can't remember which says to which, you know, oh, well, perhaps, we will actually get married and we'll have lives, you know, so it's kind of, it's not a sort of suspended animation in a sort of pre-adult world, we will have that, but we'll still sort of be separately conjoined.
Yes. I think they do, and I think that's what they will do for the rest of their lives. I made a slight mistake there. I had them meeting at midday, and Nicholas Wright, when he adapted the story for the National Theatre, had them meeting at midnight, which is much better. I wish I'd thought of that. You know, there's the moon and there's nightingales and things like that. It's much better, and there's no one else around. So that's a little improvement that came later on from someone else's hand.
I wanted to ask actually something about sort of a couple of the characters, I suppose, and maybe the one which I think probably I get the impression might have intrigued you or almost perplexed you. I don't know if that's fair as you wrote it. Is a plot issue as well, which is what happens to Mrs. Coulter, because there's this bit in I spotted it again where in the amber spyglass when Mrs. Coulter steals the intention machine.
Craft,
and she goes off. Yeah, the intention craft, sorry. And Azrael's quite so cool about it, actually. And he says, well, what... He says, I know exactly what she'll do. And as I read it, I thought, well, you do, mate, but I mean, I wonder if anybody else
I didn't
does.
Know what she was doing.
No, I actually put down, did her inventor know?
No, I hadn't a clue.
So Mrs. Coulter, her change is quite a sort of important...
No, well, I didn't know what she was going to do with the intention craft specifically, but I knew that she was going towards this this moral change, this redemption, in a word, if you want to use that sort of semi-religious term for it. She is redeemed by the by the love for Lyra that has crept up on her unsuspectingly all through the book. When we first see her, she's a monster of cruelty and cold-heartedness and... evil curiosity, if
and
you
she
like.
She tortures, doesn't
yes,
she?
Yes, she's quite willing to do that. But Lyra is her daughter, and she knows this, and she takes Lyra out of Jordan College in order to make her safe from these people who are, you know, rounding up the children. She doesn't want Lyra to have that fate. Then later on, at the end of the subtle knife, she's captured her, and she's taken her away to a cave where she's hiding her. And this is in a strange way where Mrs. Coulter... herself grows up or acquires some sort of moral bearings, because she's looking after the daughter whom she is coming to love, but she can only do it by keeping her asleep, by keeping her drugged, because she knows that the moment she wakes up, Lyra will take to the hills and flee. It's a very pitiful state to be in, if you like. You can only look after the person you love if you make them unconscious of it. But at the end of her story, Mrs. Coulter's story, when she's standing on the edge of the abyss and she confesses to Azrael about this little speck of love, this little seed that's grown and you know, come to her, and she can't resist it, this love. So she's changed and she's redeemed, and I think this is the story that fascinated me about her, and it's certainly the thing that persuaded Nicole Kidman to take the part in the film, actually, because she was also interested in this this sort of arc in film terms, this story of Mrs. Coulter's from being a morally repugnant being to one who is on the verge of being redeemed by love. So that fascinated me. That was going to happen.
And you do. I maybe this is not the first time, the only time, but there's a moment in The Amber Spyglass, which is actually, if you're a literary critical pedant like me, sort of slightly shocking. I'm sure no normal reader would sort of pause for a moment, where suddenly we're actually in her head. And you know, I got used to the books to quite a few different points of view. But there's this scene where suddenly you get the communication between her and the monkey, as it were, from her point of view. And I've been used to seeing her from the... I mean, was that a sort of meditated decision, or was it something...
It was and it wasn't. I had to go there because that was the only way I had of describing what was happening there.
Yeah.
So there was no other eyewitness there. But I had prepared the way for that by being fairly free about the point of view thing. The point of view thing is terribly important.
Yes.
You're absolutely right.
Yes.
And there are so many ways you can do it. You can tell the story in the first person, which is obviously easy. Easy in one sense, because you're limited to one pair of eyes, and you have a sort of technical problem in that if you want the reader to be aware of something, you have to make that character plausibly aware of it too. But there are ways around that. Then there's the describing the character in the third person, but sticking to their point of view. And then there's the one which I'm doing in this book, where you the point of view can sort of float between them, and it can also look at Lyra from the outside and say things about her. For example, it can say of Lyra, as it does in the beginning, in the third chapter, actually, in many ways, Lyra was a barbarian. She was a coarse and greedy little savage. Now, this is not something, for example, that Lyra would have said of herself, and it's not something that that a child would have said of another child. So the voice that's telling, the voice that's saying that, is the voice of an adult who's looking at her from the outside, sympathetically and closely, but not uncritically. And that's a very interesting... that's a very interesting point of view, that voice, and it's been underused in the 20th century in literary fiction, because the great discoveries of modernism about 100 years ago led thoughtful writers and readers to believe that the narrative voice was limited and partial and could not know everything. And of course that's true, but it can say all sorts of things. And it can go to all sorts of places if you allow it to do so. George Eliot was not in the least embarrassed about telling us what Dorothea was thinking and what Mr. Bulstrode was thinking and what Fred Vincey was thinking. She went all over the place. And when you think about this narrative voice, it is the most extraordinary thing. It can't be a human voice, if you think about it, because human beings don't have the power of going into other people's minds and telling us what's going on there. So is it a sprite? Is it an elf? Is it some sort of... what is it? I found myself puzzling about this 40 years ago when I wrote my very first novel. What is this extraordinary voice that can go into this? I'm still puzzled about it, but I think it's so fascinating and so rewarding to write with this miraculous voice that can do these strange things, these strange inhuman things, that I'm absolutely fascinated by it. We still see it in children's fiction, of course. And we see it in a book that I've just finished reading, very nearly finished reading, a book that's coming out next year by Philip Henshaw, a book which I think is absolutely marvellous, called The Northern Clemency. It's his new novel. And he uses the same voice. But that was what was happening in the scene you mentioned. That sprite, or whatever it was, whatever it is, this mysterious narrative thing, this will-o'-the-wisp that can go anywhere, was going perforce into Mrs. Coulter's mind, because that was the best place to see this bit of the story from.
Yeah, it's funny reading the trilogy as an adult, and I suppose as a sort of critic as well, and seeing these kind of, in a way, quite sort of difficult things being done in children's, supposedly, you know, books which are there for children. I noticed, this is another bad habit, but I got into the habit of noticing the words you used. And I don't know if they were just naturally the words you'd use, or if you were particularly conscious of kind of producing quite a rich recipe for, you know, for this, the books are read by sort of, I don't know, 10-year-olds and 11-year-olds, and I started kind of listing these words. I think some of my undergraduates might not know
Which,
this is from I was evanescent, sanguine, calumny. That's a good one. Nimbus, stridulation, decoction. Yeah. People leaping to their feet to define these, but you don't explain what, although you use them in a context where one could.
Well, that's the point.
Of course.
If she's preparing a decoction and you describe how she's doing it, do you know what a decoction is? That's not difficult. Stridulation, well, obviously that's that will come into context. It tells you it's the sound that insects make.
Yeah.
This is fun, actually. It's fun for me to do that, and it's fun when you're a reader, when you're a young reader. I remember learning to read on Rudyard Kipling's Just So stories, which are full of words like that. It's delicious, actually, if you've got a taste for language, to come across a word that you've never come across before, and you want to, you sort of say it to yourself and you whisper it, you get the feel of it in your mouth, and you've learned something, you've found a new word, and it's lovely, it's great. So I didn't have any hesitation at all about using that sort of language, and of course the words I made up, such as anbaric for electric. But again, you know, people can get the sense of that. No, children take it in their stride. It's adults who have a bit more difficulty, perhaps.
And what about that? So there's also a rich sort of mix of borrowings and references to other books and things, which quite a lot of which are optional, I suppose. You can notice them if you notice them, and not if you don't. But the ones which were, I mean, I suppose obviously the ones which I particularly enjoyed were the ones which were from my favourite book, Paradise Lost, and which does seem to be sort of pretty, you know, I mean, your publishers perhaps were sort of very kind of enterprising people, but I would imagine that a children's writer going and saying, well, I've got this you know, 1,200-page trilogy, and it's kind of woven in some ways around, you know, some of the images and ideas from Paradise Lost. It's quite a sort of, what do they call it? Quite a fetch, isn't it?
Many publishers would have quailed. But my publisher, David Fickling, is a man of great enterprise and courage and daring and foolhardiness, maybe. But he said, great, yes, go ahead. Because he happened to have done books 1 and 2 of Paradise Lost, just as I had, for A-level. And we sat over lunch swapping our favourite lines. One of my favourite passages from book 2 is an extended metaphor. As when far off at sea a fleet descried hangs in the clouds by equinoctial winds close sailing from Bengala or the isles of Ternate and Tidore, whence merchants bring their spicy drugs. They on the trading flood through the wide Ethiopian to the Cape ply stemming nightly toward the pole. So seemed far off the flying fiend. Satan is flying through the wastes of hell, and that's what he seems like, a long, long metaphor like that. I used a couple of long similes, actually, in the fight between the bears, in that same sort of way. I described them as the two great rocks which start by moving slowly down and slowly gather speed, and then, you know, it's a long simile. And that occurs perfectly naturally in the bear fight. And perhaps one or two adults will have recognized the sort of thing I was doing. But it doesn't matter if you don't, because that's a very good way of describing what was happening. So I wasn't in the least worried about or embarrassed about using these literary tricks. And they are literary. Tricks is not quite the word for them. They're techniques, aren't they? They're tools. They're things that we use for a particular effect. And I was happy to reach into the box of tools and take them out.
The one I most liked, if I may share it with you, is there's quite a lot of, I don't know if this is a word, I think it is, angelology in it. And some of you might know that in Paradise Lost, Milton's fantastic on angelology. I mean, he goes into real details about what angels are like and whether... In book 5 of Paradise Lost, there's a great bit where Raphael comes down to see Adam and Eve, and they're about to have breakfast in paradise, and he sort of says, "Well, that looks good," And they said, what you eat? He said, certainly do.
Yes.
I mean, the lines are a bit more resonant than that. But and there's this a great bit which I hope I'm right as sort of a sort of little bit of secret or not so secret parody for fellow Paradise Lost lovers, where the angel
Balthamos,
who's accompanying
Will.
It's Kendall Mint Cake rather than the fruits of paradise, isn't there?
Yes, I enjoyed that. I thought, well, why not? Let's have an angel and Kendall Mint Cake in the same sentence. So he nibbles it rather fastidiously.
And there's about angels, whether angels kind of love each other or not, because that also gets discussed, doesn't it?
In Paradise Lost, yes. And Raphael blushes.
Yes.
Doesn't he, when discussing this?
Yeah.
We do sometimes, yes, sort of thing. Paradise Lost, I just adore. It's the most wonderful, majestic, eternally refreshing work. And so I'm happy to steal from it.
I mean, that brings me to sort of, well, I must open it up in a second, but the kind of, I suppose, the last question I wanted to ask was about Paradise Lost, but about the sort of paradox, you know, what some might think of a paradox, that the book has aroused some kind of controversy for the representation of religion in it, and yet the two books which seem to most invigorate it are Paradise Lost, and the Bible,
yeah, yeah.
Mm. And it reminds me of it because we're one of the previous Guardian book clubs, very different kind of thing, but a similar sort of paradox in a way that Jeanette Winterson came and talked about oranges are not the only fruit, and everybody knows it's the story of this extraordinary sort of fanatically evangelical mother that she had, and or stepmother, foster mother, and adopted mother, and her efforts to sort of, in a way, to escape, and yet her book is all structured by the names of books of the Bible, and it's full of sort of biblical language. I mean, that's a sort of, that is a sort of paradox. Is that the right word?
I'm not sure that it is a paradox, because I'm talking about big things such as death, such as God, such as whether life has a purpose and all that sort of thing, which are big things, and I'm talking about them in the language and in the terms that they've always been talked about, because these are terms and language and things proper to these big discussions. Naturally, I'm going to talk about religion and what one believes, and whether it's important to live one's life in a moral way or not. Of course, it's going to touch on religious things. I can't help it anyway, because I was brought up in the Church of England, and I went to church every Sunday, and my mind was formed by the Bible and by the prayer book and by the hymns that we used to sing in my grandfather's church. I can't escape it any more than I can escape my the Latin that was drilled into me from the age of 7, so that when I look at a word, I can sort of see whether it's Latin or whether it's, you know, it's inescapable. The criticism comes, it seems to me, from people who think that there is only one way of reading the Bible, and it's their way, and if you read it another way, you're doing something wrong or evil or something. That's not what I believe. I think there are many ways of reading the many books of the Bible, because they're not all the same thing at all. It's appropriate to read one part of it as history, another part of it as poetry, another part of it as law, another part of it as nonsense, and so on. And we should use our judgment, our human judgment, which has been formed by our education and by our experience of the world and of reading other things, to decide which is the appropriate way to read it in each case, rather than the one literally, this is literally true, and if you read it any other way, you're going to go to hell, which is the fundamentalist way of reading the Bible, which I think is wrong, simply wrong.
Maybe.
I'm not sure whether I answered your question.
Well, I'm sure there are lots of people here who've got questions. I've had my go. So if anybody would like to stick up their hand, and, oh, a lady there who's dressed in orange and therefore gets the first question.
Yes, I'm interested in the demons, and wondering what technique you used to work out what the demon of a character would be.
Well, the demons, I didn't use a technique. It was just, it was obvious, really, that Lord Boreal's demon should be a snake, for example. You can have a good, you know, you can be a good person with a snake or a bad person with a snake, but there's something serpentine, subtle, sinuous about their nature, and it says something about them. So in most cases, it was quite easy to assign a demon to the character. I didn't think of demons from the very beginning. Demons came at a stage when I'd already written the first chapter several times without any success. I think I've told this story many times, but I tried to make the first chapter work before I discovered demons, and it didn't work simply because Lyra was on her own going into the room and she didn't have anyone to talk to. And you know, I had to do that thing of going into her mind and telling you what she felt and what she was thinking and what she was wondering at the same time as telling you what she's doing. And that's a bit boring. It's heavy going. It's much, much easier, much more dynamic if there's another character there that she can talk to. So the demon appeared, Lyra and her demon, first four words of the book. And once I'd got that, it became very much easier to write that first chapter. But the first time I wrote it like that, everybody's demon changed form all the time, adults as well as children, and I realized that that wouldn't work. After a while, I thought, we'll get sick of this, because it's not doing anything. It's not expressing anything. It's just a bit of scenery. And I'll get bored with it, and I'll get fed up with it, and I'll forget. But I'd realized by then that the book, the story as a whole, was going to be about the change from innocence to experience, in Blake's terms. It's going to be about growing up. And if I could use the demon idea to sort of express this, it wouldn't be oppressive and boring, and it wouldn't get in the way. So that's why I realized that children's demons are the ones that change, and then gradually they stop changing. And when I realized that, the moment that I realized that was the most exciting moment I've ever had as a writer, because all sorts of things became clear then, all sorts of things became possible, and they remained. I mean, it remains a very rich metaphor that I haven't fully explored yet. I discovered something about it just last year, last November. They needed a new scene for the film. They needed a scene for Nicole as Mrs. Coulter, because there was a patch of about half an hour where we didn't see her. And so I wrote a scene in which she is looking through the photographs of Lyra that she's got, and the monkey starts interfering and fiddling with it, and she smacks him. She clouts him one. And he knocks to the floor. And then she picks him up and sort of soothes him, and she's got red marks, you know, finger marks down the side of her face. And I'd never realized that that was possible or that a character would do that, but suddenly that seemed to me the right thing for her to do. That's a very good scene. So I'm still discovering things that the demon can do.
The demon idea is it's a brilliant one. I began to find it in Northern Lights, when they actually talk about separating. I actually started to find it physically painful myself. Actually made me quite squeamish. I thought this blinking man's invented this thing, and it's giving me an absolutely horrible feeling, which is he's completely.
It's exactly what I wanted you to do. But it works. That separation thing and the horror thing works because I've spent the previous 300 pages setting it up and establishing the fact that you can't be separated from your demon, and suddenly you are, and you think, oh my God, it's horrible. Another little difference between films and books, the demon idea works on the page because you don't see them all the time. You see them when I draw your attention to the demon, when they do something or say something that's important. And in a film, of course, you have to see them all the time, or because they're there all the time. And we when we were talking about it, I pointed this out, and they tried to do it as discreetly as possible. So it's not like a zoo, you know. When you don't need to see the demon, they're in your pocket or something.
Yeah. Yes. If you could, if anybody else who wants to ask the next question could put up their hand, then we can. We've got a young question, Jennifer.
Talking of the film, to what extent do you think it's a mistake for anyone to see a film of a book so vividly imagined on the page? It seems to me that in many ways it might destroy your illusions of the book.
Well. If I agreed with you, I'd be saying, don't go and see the film, and I want lots of people to see the film. We know now, after 100 years of experience of books and films, what the relationship is, don't we? We sort of expect to be disappointed. That's more or less what we sort of expect. Of a book, you know, we've enjoyed, and we know she won't look like that, and he wouldn't say that, and they left this bit out, and they've changed the ending, and all that sort of stuff. So that's what we sort of expect. But if you go with low, somebody, a friend of mine said, if you go with very low expectations, you have a good time. I couldn't possibly say that, but you know,
perhaps the difference is that I would imagine a very large proportion of people going to see the film will actually have read the books, rather than that dangerous thing of the, somehow the film nudging the books aside.
This is a difficult thing, isn't it? And it's impossible. If you know the book, you can't sort of unknow it for the purpose of looking at the film. You can't forget the things you know. So we just have to hope that the people who know the books already aren't too disappointed, and the people who don't know the books are intrigued enough to go and buy them.
We've got a question right at the front.
When you made the Elysiometer, did you have a picture of all the different pictures and their meanings, like on paper or in your mind or something?
No, I didn't initially. I thought it should have 36 pictures around the edge, because that's a good number, and it's, you know, you can, if you imagine a thing about that big and you've got 36 little divisions, it's roughly big enough to have a little tiny picture in each one, and you can sort of see what it is. So I thought that was about the right number. And when I started thinking about it, or when I needed Lyra to read the Elysiometer, I just made up whatever it was she needed at that point in the story. But later on, I had to describe the Elysiometer for the artist to draw it on the cover of the hardback. And then they prepared a little leaflet with a sort of fold-out thing and instructions for reading the Elysiometer, so I had to go into it in a bit more, detail. And explain what all the symbols were and the first couple of meanings in each case. But I haven't gone much further than that. Somebody's making me one, actually. I thought it would be nice to have one, so the jeweller is actually making me one. But I don't know if I'll be able to read it yet.
Yes, one in the middle there, and then one up there. Oh, can we? Oh, we've got a cross purposes. So, okay.
Excuse me. I've seen the play version of His Dark Materials, and they left out the character of Mary Malone in there. How does that affect the story?
Well, you're right. The stage version at the National Theatre had to leave out quite a lot. And because, after all, to read the book aloud takes 35 hours, and the two plays took six, so it's going to lose a lot. The character of Mary Malone was one of the characters that had to go, but I thought it was important that her function in the story should be preserved. What she does, the important thing she does in the story, of course, is to tell Lyra at that stage when they're out of danger and they're in this strange world where it's all peaceful and calm. She tells Lyra how she, Mary, fell in love. They're just chatting over the fire after supper. And she remembers a time when she fell in love with a boy who gently lifted a piece of marzipan to her lips and put it into her mouth. And Lyra notices this and remembers it, and she knows that Will is also listening, and he's heard it too. And next day, when they're alone in the woods, and they have a little, it's a strange mood they're in, that everything's quiet and hushed. And she remembers this, and she knows that when she takes a little bit of fruit and lifts it to his lips, he will know what that means. It's very important that they both know what it means. That's why Mary has to tell her that story. Now, in the stage version, we gave that story to the witch, to Serafina Pecola, to tell. So the function was preserved, even though the character went. So the story still worked.
Yeah. Why did you choose to make Lyra lose the ability to read the Athelmeter?
Why did I give Lyra the ability to read the Athelmeter? Well, she needed some way of finding things out. That was one reason for it. She needed the sort of help that she could have got these days by using her mobile phone. But they didn't have those. And so I needed to give her something that would tell her things that... Well, things about Will, for example. When she first sees Will, She's not sure who this strange boy without a demon is, and she's puzzled by him. Is he a friend or an enemy? She asks the alethiometer, and it says, because it knows Lyra, it says, he is a murderer. And then she relaxed, safe. So she needed something like that. But there was another reason that I gave her the alethiometer, which is that she must, before the end of the story, forget how to read it. She must lose the power to read it. And this is important because it's also to do with growing up. There is a way of regaining the power, but it's a conscious way. She's come to it sort of unconsciously by a process of instinct and intuition and those things. And when she forgets how to do it, it's a tragedy for her. She thinks, oh, this wonderful thing, it's been taken away, I'll never get it back. But she's told there is a way, and it's the way that the few grown-ups we've seen in the story who can read it do it. They use the books. It's education. She has to learn. It's a long process and a tedious process and a difficult and a heartbreaking process sometimes, but it does work. And eventually, when Lyra is grown up, I promise you, she will read the alethiometer again, and she will be better at it than she was before because she will see why things happen as well as just what things are happening. So those were the two reasons why Lyra has the alethiometer. And perhaps the second one's more important. Sorry.
Yes, Jenny, next to you, the gentleman with the beard, and then...
What gave you ideas of different worlds?
Different worlds. Well, now, you know, the different worlds idea is something that many storytellers have used. You know the story of Alice? Alice who went down the rabbit hole and found herself in Wonderland. And then the other book, she went through the looking glass, found herself in the looking glass world. Well, that's two different world stories. And then there's the story whose name I can't quite remember, about a little girl who goes to the back of a wardrobe. What's that called? That one, you know. Same story there. And in Gulliver's Travels, if you think about it, Gulliver sets off on his ship and goes way, way round oceans, far, far away, and finds himself in a land full of little people. That's another way of going into another world. So storytellers have always used this device. I just borrowed the ideas of modern physics, which I don't understand at all. but I could understand the bits in between the equations. In a very interesting book by David Deutsch, who's a professor of physics at Oxford. He's given a couple of lectures that I've gone to, and he's a leading proponent of this many worlds idea, the idea that every time there's a little quantum event, the little particle jumps here instead of jumping that way. In fact, it jumps both ways, but in the other another world immediately springs into being in which it jumped the other way. It's like spinning a coin. What is it? Tails. But it's also, in another world, it's heads. And then things can diverge from that moment on, and other worlds come into being. So I just borrowed the science of it, which I don't, as I say, don't fully understand. But it's a very old storytelling idea, and it's been used many times and will be used many times again. Also, a lot of science fiction's like that. You get in a rocket, you go somewhere else and have an adventure, and then you come back again. It's the same sort of thing.
There's several... Yeah, if that... Yes, yes? If you wait for the mic... I'll give you all a try. Are there any grown-ups who desperately want to ask a question as well? Oh yes. Okay. If you right. So you have to go here.
You know the you know Lord Borrow. Why did Mrs. Coulter? What gave you the inspiration to give her so much power, like over the spectres and all that? When they just killed the other guys.
Yeah, well, she is a wicked woman. And where she gets all her powers from, I don't know. I couldn't explain that bit. You've asked me to... You put your finger very cleverly on a bit I can't explain. I don't know how she got that power, but it's the sort of thing she'd be able to do, isn't it?
Yeah, because she's quite confident, isn't she? That she
Yeah. She's
got
I can deal with them.
Yeah.
I can deal with them. She's a bit like Mrs. Thatcher, really. I can deal with them. I can deal with them. Arthur Scargill, no trouble. I can deal with him. So, I don't know.
Okay, yes, sorry. Sorry. I'm very sorry.
It's just that when... you said that the witches could... the spectres couldn't fly.
Yeah.
That the witches, when they were guarding Lyra, and Will was off... And Will was off on the tent, or Miss Coulter. They said that they had been attacked in midair.
Well, you see, Professor, there are critics here tonight who surpass your...
George Eliot never had to cope with it.
No, she didn't. You're quite right. Perhaps they... I don't know. And maybe it was when they just flew down a bit too low and they could get in touch.
I think you've scored your hit. I think we'll... Now, there's one here who's had her hand up for quite a long time. And right at the front, Ginny. Please.
Why did you choose to put the religious plot in the Amber Spyglass?
Well, it was there from the beginning, actually, because it was always the power... I mean, the power that has dominion in that world is a religious power. And I wanted that to be there because that's the most dangerous sort of power, it seems to me. A power that rules in the name of something that may not be questioned. Religion, and this is something I've said a good few times, religion is something that is very good when it is far away from power. When it concerns itself with the poor, with the suffering, with the oppressed, with injustice, with that sort of thing, with the sick, religion does good things. But when you give it political power, when you give it the power to send armies into war or to order people to be executed or to be to reach into our lives and tell us what to wear and what to eat and drink and so on, when it has that sort of power, the power of punishing people, basically, it goes bad very, very quickly. And I wanted to see what it was like to imagine a world in which religious power had that sort of authority. That's why it came in.
If you carried on the books, what would Lyra grow up to do?
I've just finished a story called Once Upon a Time in the North, which is a sort of companion book to Lyra's Oxford, which is a little short story, really, with some extra bits in it. Well, this is a short story with some extra bits in it. And it's a story about two of my favourite characters, Lee Scoresby and Yorick Birnison. When we meet them in Northern Lights, they're already old friends. They've fought side by side on many, rescued each other from danger and so on. Well, my son said to me a while ago now, he'd like to read the story when they first met, when they were young. And I thought, that's an interesting story. So I've written that. And it happens a long time before Lyra's born, actually. So she doesn't come into the story directly, but there's a little clue in one of the extra bits about what Lyra's doing 10 years or so after the end of the Amber Spyglass.
Hi. I was just wondering about whether you, the characters in the book, are predestined at all. With the demons, for example, servants all have dogs as demons. And I wondered whether the demons are a sort of a view of the predestination of these characters, or whether the demons are dogs because they become servants.
Yeah, I mean, that's a question that other people have wondered about. So perhaps I didn't make it very clear in the story, but it's not a limiting thing. It's not a determining thing. If your demon is a dog, it means that you're happy in a sort of structure where you know who has the authority, where you know who's the boss. Dogs like to know who's in charge. And if you have a group of dogs, a pack of dogs, there's a top dog and there's a bottom dog and there's they all know their place in the order. And they like that. It keeps them happy. They know where they are. And it seemed to me that if your demon was a dog, it would tell you that you'd be happy working in a sort of structure where there was someone in charge and you were happy to obey orders and carry them out. It doesn't say anything about your character apart from that. It doesn't say whether you're good or bad or strong or weak or clever or silly. It just says that's the sort of person you are and you'd be happy in that sort of structure. So it would probably turn out, as I said in the story, that if your demon is a dog, you'd be quite happy being a servant. And there are some people who, I've no doubt, would be happy carrying out orders and making sure that things are all right for the people in charge and so on. So that's why, but it doesn't say anything more about you than that.
I was quite intrigued about the concept of dust and how it's like so complex and you use it to portray so many things like puberty and the universe and everything, really.
It's one of those all-purpose symbols. No, it means... well, now, here I'm wondering whether I should interpret my own work and tell you what it means. I'm kind of reluctant to tell you what things mean, because as I'm the chap who wrote it, that gives me a sort of authority in this field. But I'm not sure that I do have that sort of authority, because if you've got a theory about what dust means and you've worked it out, you have every right to do that. When the book is finished and published, the autocracy of writing, which is an autocratic procedure, I'm a despot, I'm a tyrant when I write, because I have absolute power of life and death over every sentence, every comma, every character. I can kill them, I can bring them to life, I can cut off this end of this chapter and start somewhere else. I am the authority, and no one can tell me not to do it. But once the book is published, the autocracy of authorship comes to an end and the democracy of reading begins. And that's the point where I cease to have any authority. I can't tell you what it means. I can tell you what I think it means. And so can anybody else. But if I tell you what I think it means, because I wrote the book, people might think that that is what it really means and there's no more argument about it. But I don't want that to happen. I want there to be discussion about it. I want you to think what all the things it might mean. And you've come up with a good few things there. But you have asked me a question. It's unfair to evade it. I'll just say the word consciousness and leave it at that.
There you go. That's your essay. Title. Not the essay, just the title. I think we got time for two more, I think. You've got two up there. Right, an adult and a child in front. Okay.
Hi, I'd like to, one of the first books of yours that I read was Clockwork, and you say in that the stories are like clockwork, when you wind them up, nothing can stop them. And in that book, you've got a character called Fritz the Novelist, and you describe him as being irresponsible, because he starts off telling a story and he doesn't know the ending. But the way you've described writing Dark Materials is very much like that. So to what extent do you equate yourself to Fritz, and to what extent do you see yourself as being different?
Well, he made the mistake of standing up in front of an audience beginning his story without any idea of how to finish it. And then he was taken aback when one of the characters he just described actually comes into the door and says, "Please carry on. Don't let me interrupt. Just carry on what you were doing." And, of course, that terrifies him. I actually did finish my story before I showed it to anyone. So I'm not quite in the position of Fritz, the irresponsible storyteller. Actually, I think what I said to be accurate in that story was some stories are like clockwork. When you wind them up, they have to keep going. And no matter how much the characters would like to change their fate, they can't, because they're caught up in it. I was quite proud of Clockwork. I think it's a jolly good story, but thank you for mentioning it.
Okay.
And this is the last, is it? Last
yes. Question?
Okay, right.
You probably didn't do this on purpose, but I noticed when you have the demons, they tend to turn, when they have a fixed form, they tend to turn into a creature that has the same letter at the beginning of their name as their actual name.
Really? Well, yeah. I didn't notice that.
I don't think it happens for all of them, but for quite a few it does.
Well, that's very clever of you to notice that. I hadn't spotted that at all. Thank you. I'll now you've drawn that to my attention. I shall do it on purpose in the future.